So, Josh,
what?
What do you think is the most recognizable, arguably cult hit movie ever made?
I think that's kind of debatable, but...
No, it's not.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
What'd you do?
I love Rocky Horror.
See, I'm kind of on the fence about it. I hate the movie.
Oh,
but
the movie
I love
is,
the music.
I was going to say the movie is terrible.
Yeah, it's terribly acted, terribly directed. I hate the production design. I hate the script. I love the music. Does that make any sense?
No, the music is really, really good. Especially Meatloaf's bit.
Something Saturday Night.
I always called it Saturday Night.
I actually really like Creature of the Night.
Creature of the Night is very good. But of course, we opened with quite possibly the most recognizable song from the movie.
Yeah, it's the one that every Halloween, I don't care if you're a rock station, a pop station, every radio station plays that around Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
And tonight's topic, in case you haven't guessed, is cult movies.
Yes. And our definition, just to let you know, of a cult movie is a movie that, in the theaters, relatively bombed.
Well, no, I want to correct you. Not in the theaters. We'll say in its initial run.
Initial run of the,
because
okay, yeah.
There are straight-to-video movies that have become cult that, like, flopped on videotape.
True.
So just saying theatrical
initial,
kind of,
initial
that's a little too narrow.
Run. There we go.
I think your vision's a little narrow there.
Okay.
So I just want to point that out.
No problem.
But cult movies.
You want to do the show too? You just want? I can shut off my mic and leave.
You know, the last couple of weeks you've been such a fucking bitch.
Is it
your fucking time of the week or something?
I think so. I got to be honest. Really, work has been really stacking up, which isn't a bad thing because that means hours, and hours mean money. But this is a bitch.
You're a bitch.
I go into things like today. I went into a Super Kmart, which is about the same size as a Super Walmart, maybe a little smaller, but not much.
Cult movies.
I know, but I have to measure the entire store within a 2-inch tolerance and then map the whole thing. It's a pain in the ass. I've been working for 13 hours today, and I've got probably another 13 hours of work tomorrow.
Can we talk about cult movies now?
Back to cult movies, sorry.
Okay.
Just explaining and apologizing
for. A little bit of whining is what he's doing.
Pity me. Send me money.
There's a PayPal link on my website, 1201beyond.blogspot.com.
That's your website. I said send me money.
Well, maybe I'll split it with you.
Okay.
All right. So to me, a cult movie, its definition is kind of vague because some people would describe like the midnight movie scene, especially of the 70s, as cult movies, and I would be one of them. Those are films that in their normal 7 p.m., theatrical showings were bombs.
Oh, yeah.
Showing them at midnight to a bunch of potheads. These movies, in some cases, ran for years. Every Friday and Saturday night, uninterrupted.
Well, sticking with music movies that have done that, you've got, of course, Rocky Horror.
Longest running film of all time.
Exactly.
Really.
And then you've got Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yeah, you got Pink Floyd. Not really music, but there's a great example of why a cult movie should not be taken mainstream. And that is El Topo.
El Topo.
It's this weird Italian Western. And the movie was a monster hit.
Okay.
On the midnight movie circuit. And it was seen by John Lennon. And he loved it. So he went and bought the rights to the movie.
Really?
And he went and released it mainstream. In a main wide release across the entire country. It bombed like you wouldn't believe. So then he brought it back to the midnight circuit. It was selling out theaters again.
Wow.
It just goes to show there are some movies that don't work at 7 p.m.
This is
on
true.
A Wednesday. They just don't work there. And El Topo is a perfect example of a movie that needs to be a cult movie, and it does not work for the mainstream. Where else are you going to see an armless, legless cowboy shooting people? I mean, with outside of El Topo, you're not going to see that.
Not since P.T. Barnum really isn't around anymore, is he? So,
right. And Todd Browning's Freaks didn't have freak cowboys in it. But so there are examples like that. And then there are movies like Night of the Living Dead,
which has become
cult, not so much because of its theatrical run or even video, but late night TV.
Oh, yeah.
Late night TV is where almost every one of us saw this movie, because this movie is public domain and has been since the day it opened because of literally a typo.
Welcome to a night of total terror.
The infamous theremin.
Oh yeah, well, 1968, night. So what do you expect?
Of the living dead, the dead who live on living flesh. The dead whose haunted souls hunt the living. The living whose bodies are the only food for these ungodly creatures.
Do you know why this movie is both the most profitable and least profitable film of all time?
No, how does that work?
It works just because of almost serendipity, really.
Okay.
Okay, the film was originally called Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Okay.
And that's what they copyrighted it under.
All right.
Well, there was another movie out called The Flesh Eaters. So to not be confused with that, they changed the title at the last minute to Night of the Living Dead. Problem is, they didn't change the copyright holding.
Really?
So the movie, since the day it was released, has been public domain, and the producers, the director, George Romero, and that have not made 1 cent off the movie.
Oh.
So that's why it's the most profitable film of all time, because every one of us has been able to profit off this movie by showing it on TV. That's why, like, even now, a Halloween, go to the Halloween aisle of Walmart, you'll see 4 or 5 different DVD releases of a public domain copy of Night of the Living Dead for 99 cents. Because anybody can put this out. And you saw that on VHS. You see it on... That's why, I mean, literally, it was on 6 channels last Halloween.
Have they released a Blu-ray yet?
Probably. Well, because it is copyrighted in its later incarnations. Like, Elite Entertainment went and did a digital remaster, just made the... I mean, it was gorgeous.
Oh, okay.
And then you're able to recopyright your version of it. So the Elite Entertainment version is copyrighted, and that's the one that they're putting out on, you know, the official with commentary and stuff like that.
Cool.
But that's why Night of the Living Dead, I think, is both the most profitable and least profitable film of all time.
No, that's really neat. I didn't realize that such a simple, what you would think would be a simple error gave us, like you said, one of the most popular.
You can't do that anymore.
Okay.
See, That changed in the early 80s. When you changed the title, you had to recopyright it. That's why a lot of, especially foreign films, when they'd have, like, you know, 20 minutes cut out to get it down to an hour and a half, and then they'd put a new title on it, they'd forget to recopyright that new title.
So
that's why you've got all
films.
These Dario Argento films in the public domain, like the great Jennifer Connelly giant bug or a mentally controlling bug movie, Creepers. We know it as Creepers. Because that's a public domain American cut. It was released as Phenomena everywhere else.
Really?
Phenomena is copyrighted. Creepers is public domain.
Neat.
Or another one would be Communion. It was a movie originally called Communion. It starred a then unknown, well, not starred, she has a small role, a then unknown Brooke Shields.
Okay.
And it was called Communion. Then Brooke Shields got really popular. So they retitled the movie to name it after her character, and it was re-released as Alice Sweet Alice. They never copyrighted it under Alice Sweet Alice.
So
if you have a print called Alice Sweet Alice, it's public domain. The prints for Communion are copyrighted.
You know, speaking of Brooke Shields.
Oh, God.
I caught her in a very old film. And I think she had to be about 12 when it was made. Pretty Baby.
I don't know that one. She was really young in Alice Sweet Alice.
Really terrible.
But so... That's why some of these films, that's why there's so many more modern films in the public domain, is usually because of re-edits and, we forgot to recopyright the new title.
Now, I have an interesting movie because it's one of those movies that was really, really goofy. It did okay in its initial theatrical run.
Okay.
It did all right. But because the movie was so expensive to make, and this is back when they didn't fudge numbers quite so much.
It basically needed to be a hit to make
it back. Yeah, it needed to be the next Jaws. And it came out in 1981. So it really literally needed to be the next Jaws.
Or Star Wars.
Or Star Wars. And it pretty much failed in the theater, but it built up quite a following.
I'm going to go again on TV. Because I obviously I can see what you're about to play.
Right.
I saw this movie in the theater, but I caught it more on TV. I saw this... I'm going to have to say the company, the Disney Channel, showed this movie constantly.
Especially during the sequel release.
Well, no, I'm talking back in the 80s when the Disney Channel was a pay channel. They showed this movie all the time. Along with The Black Hole.
But yeah, it also showed up, like I said, it's gotten a recent sequel, and it's absolutely
no... Sequel sucks.
Yeah, it's not very good. But nonetheless, it also is one of those movies that speaks to geeks. And I think that's part of what made it a cult
thing. Of
which
we are both.
The first time I saw it, by the way, on Laserdisc with a friend. And
you didn't see this theatrically?
No, I didn't.
I did. I remember my mom took me to see this.
I was also in Australia.
Oh, okay. The Aussies probably got it late.
Yep, they did.
Out there, do you recognize that?
Tons of awards for sound design, for set design, for post-production things that people had never tried.
No, actually, the post-production is what people shit all over.
Really?
Do you know why this was, and this is so ironic nowadays?
Tron, if you haven't guessed.
Yes. Tron, do you know why this was disqualified for an Academy Award for Best Special Effects?
Why?
Using the computer to create the effect was cheating.
Boy, that is ironic.
That's why I'm saying in today's day and age, it's so ironic that this film probably would have won, but it was disqualified because a computer making the special effect is cheating for the special effect Oscar. How fucked is that in retrospect?
Wow. And of course, you look at it today and you're like, wow, are these effects dated?
No,
and...
I will fight with you on that. I think... these look exactly like my son. Looking back at this is exactly how he would have expected 1981 or 82 CGI to look.
Sure.
So in that aspect, I don't call it dated, and I do, because it looks like the way it's supposed to look. Does that make any sense?
I think you summed it up beautifully. This looks exactly how you'd expect 1981 CGI to look. Terribly dated, not unimpressive.
Which is part of the problem with the sequel. It just looks like CGI, and it looks bad.
It doesn't have a year to it. It doesn't have... Plus, they change all the rules of the universe, and it pissed me off.
And it looks... Honestly, it looks way too modern.
And I don't know if it was Sid Mead that lost it, or the movie that lost Sid Mead. And I believe it was Tron that lost Sid Mead. Who designed all the vehicles and everything?
Yeah,
he's a great futurist.
Oh yeah, he designed stuff for Blade Runner and Alien and Conan and.
But you can definitely tell that he was gone. Now sticking with that kind of geeky feel to it, there's another movie out there that I know you know.
I love this film.
Yes, it is, and it's got one of those end credits that everybody loves if you've seen it.
I bet you all guessed what it was just from that, didn't you? Dare you out there not to be humming this tonight.
Or whistling. And I realize it's played on a keyboard, but you can't help but whistle along.
No, you can't. Did you know that there's a modern movie that pays homage to this end sequence?
Really?
Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. The end sequence where they're all meeting up and walking along the dock, it was actually timed out to this. Because the director was such a fan of Buckaroo Banzai. that it's actually timed out, that if you play this music over it, it'll match.
Neat.
It was a specific homage. And Jeff Goldblum's in both films.
Neat.
As just another little connection to Life Aquatic. And see, that always pissed me off. When Clancy Brown comes out, he dies in the movie. Why is he joining them in the end credits? Were they teasing us
with
something?
They're all dead.
You know, I mean, okay, Buckaroo Banzai also set a nice big record back in 84. And keep in mind, it bombed in its initial theatrical release.
Oh yeah, I know. It did terribly.
And it set a record.
Really?
Now keep in mind, this is the early days of video. Best-selling videotape of all time in 1984.
Really?
It totally found its audience on video and HBO.
Again, Buckaroo Banzai, that's another one that
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. You got to say the full title to get the effect.
Again, BB. Great movie.
I love the film.
And I watched it. I have fond memories of it simply because the first time that I saw it was sitting with my dad watching HBO. Again, we relatively early adopters of HBO.
I had HBO as of 82. So yeah.
And it was on, and I remember sitting watching with him, and my mother couldn't tell what the hell was going on in the movie. She
the
knew nothing
insane.
About it.
Intentionally, the producers put it as it's a comic book on film, and that is a really succinct way of putting it, I think.
And it unfortunately doomed itself.
This was a movie that, while I don't think they tried to make it a cult film, was destined to become one. There's no way this film was going to get mainstream acceptance.
There's another way that it doomed itself.
John Big Booty?
No.
How was that?
At the very end, did you see Coming Soon?
Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League, which technically came out.
Really?
It's called Big Trouble in Little China. Same writer.
Okay.
Took his Buckaroo Banzai 2 script and rewrote that as Big Trouble in Little China.
Really?
W.D. Richter. Now, while he said there's major, major changes, and literally, if you watch the two movies back to back, they're stylistically similar.
Yes.
You can see how the villains would be the World Crime League. And so technically, in a really weird and reaching way, Big Trouble in Little China is a sequel to Buckaroo Banzai without having Buckaroo Banzai in it.
I would like to see the script for Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League, because
the original script before
the original
became
script
Big before Trouble.
Exactly.
I'm sure you can find it on some script website. I've never read the script for that one, so I don't know what that would
be. Now, are there any other cult movies that come to your mind?
There's quite a few, but I don't want to leave Buckaroo Banzai yet.
Okay, go ahead.
Buckaroo Banzai is one of those movies that if you're a comic book geek, a sci-fi geek, a computer geek, the movie just speaks to you.
If you're a geek, period.
Yes, the movie just speaks to you. And I think if they'd marketed it properly, it could have been a somewhat mainstream success.
I don't think so.
I do, because I think there's enough mainstream humor in it.
I don't. You got to remember that back, I mean, it would be the perfect movie today.
Oh,
to market to geeks perfectly. I mean, it would work beautifully, but you got to remember back when it came out.
Well, see, no, I disagree with that, because I say Scott Pilgrim versus the World is a perfect example of a cult movie that people were trying to make a cult movie, and it failed. That movie bombed. And I think the problem with Scott Pilgrim is they went into that going, let's make a cult film. And these people don't seem to realize that a cult film can't be designed.
Yeah,
has to just sort of happen.
Yeah.
And Scott Pilgrim is a movie that was designed to be a cult film.
Yeah.
Buckaroo Banzai was the exact opposite. It was designed to be a mainstream film that became a cult film.
And here is how you can pick out a cult film that's designed to be a cult film. Let's take Scott Pilgrim for example. Speaking to a very, very specific generation at a very specific time.
With complete studio backing and a $200 million budget.
Yeah, but it was just talking, it was going, screw everybody else, they don't matter. Hey, everybody that played a Nintendo when you were young, look, here's a movie for you.
I did. I played a Nintendo when I was young. I hated the film. I found the film to be, I don't like this term, but it's the only term that's apt at this point. It seemed to be trying so hard to hit that hipster audience of, oh, you know, you've probably never heard of that group that I like.
You know?
It was trying so hard to be like that, that it it just actually angered me of how it was trying too hard get me to like it.
You didn't read the comics, did
you? No, I'd never read the comics.
The comics actually did a beautiful job of hitting that hipster geek.
The right beat.
Yeah, that right beat of hipster geek.
But to me, the movie was trying so hard to hit that it actually alienated me from liking the movie, if that makes any sense.
And, you know, to be fair, I didn't mind the film. It's the kind of movie that I put in when I want noise in the background and pretty flashy colors and I don't want to think.
See, I can't do that. To me, I just really dislike that movie.
I understand.
Because I think being a cult film fan, I think it's trying too hard to be a cult film.
Other signs that it's trying to be a cult film. It came out with the retro 8-bit video game.
Yep.
And there are plenty of references in that game, again, that pick up both in the movie and the book. And books, I should say. And but it was a try there. You had that tons and tons and tons of cross marketing. But it wasn't like, hey, McDonald's has Scott Pilgrim toys cross marketing. It was more and less subtle at the same time.
Right. So to me, Buckaroo Banzai is a complete antithesis of what Scott Pilgrim was. Because I think both films were trying to hit the same audience, and I think Buckaroo succeeded where Scott Pilgrim did not.
I agree.
Because Buckaroo is it's a very literate film, if you can follow it. Plot is sort of all over the place, but that's intentional.
Oh, yeah.
It's supposed to be not weird for the sake of weird for the sake of kind of keeping you off balance.
Let's keep the people that are too dumb to follow this movie off kilter.
Well, and kind of the point is, there's so much weird stuff in the first half hour that whenever you think you know where the plot's going in the last two thirds, you kind of go, I don't know, they might not go there because of the shit they did earlier. And I think that's a brilliant way to put the movie, you know. And then of course you got Christopher Lloyd as John Big Booty. I'm sorry, but that's funny. The Electroids from Planet 10.
He played amazingly well. He played that role amazingly well, too.
Listen up, a monkey boy.
Yes.
To John Lithgow. Listen up, a monkey boy. So
there's another film out there.
This is one of my all-time favorite movies. I call this the best bad movie ever made.
Exactly. And this was one that was absolutely panned by critics, hated by fans of the comics, of the radio show, of the TV serial, of pretty much everything else having to do with this lead character.
Well, because you have to admit, the weird part about this movie, and I'm trying to avoid the title right now because you people will recognize it when we play the theme.
Oh, yeah, within like three notes.
Is the fact that they both hit the character on the head and totally missed the point at the same time,
yes.
If that makes any sense. They did get certain aspects absolutely perfect. And other things they made so 1980 that it just destroyed what they were going for.
And the only thing that makes this movie look good is the recent TV series.
No, I love this film. I love the special effects. I love the acting.
I adore this movie. It's not a good movie, but I adore this movie.
Best bad movie ever made. Do you know it yet? You should.
And you'll know it in 3, 2, 1 now.
Good. Ah, savior
of the universe. Oh,
love this movie. Like I said, seriously, best bad movie ever made.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And like I said, hated by everyone who followed the everything from the comic to the old movie serials to everything.
My dad took me to see this. In the theater, I saw it at a midnight screening at a bar. Some bar had a theatrical print in Sturgeon Bay, and they showed it in like 81. They showed it to a bar full of drunken people. My dad took me at a midnight screening in a bar, and we watched this. I saw this on TV all the time. I have this on Laserdisc, video, DVD. I own the soundtrack on LP. I own the soundtrack on cassette. I own the soundtrack on CD. I have an original press booklet. I have an original poster for this movie. I tend to like this movie.
You know what? I actually think that may be something musically that you and I agree on.
Queen?
This world would be better if Freddie Mercury hadn't passed away.
Well, no, the way I look at it is, and I'm not trying to be crass, but he probably died before he could suck. You know, look at what happened to, I mean, look at Elvis.
But
if
wait, if
Elvis had died 10 years earlier, he'd be remembered totally differently than the fat Elvis.
And actually, come to think of it, do we both agree on Queen?
I like Queen. Wow. I know. Well, and then that actually reminded me of another cult film that Queen's involved in, Highlander. The first Highlander, absolute disaster in America. It was a hit in Europe. It was a huge hit in Europe, but they also got a 15-minute longer cut, which explained a lot of the plot holes in the movie. So
I was there.
Yeah, so maybe if we'd gotten the correct cut, it might have worked better in America. I don't know.
Mm.
But the fact there's two different cuts that kind of could have played differently.
But anyway.
But Highlander, total disaster in America, monster success on cable.
Oh, yeah.
That was a cable staple. In the 80s. And I saw Highlander for the first time then. And that reminded me of another one. Brazil. Total, absolute flop in America. It was actually almost every English-speaking European country said, this is one of the best films of 1985. Well,
it won some BAFTA awards, didn't it?
Yeah. But the American cut, totally panned. Hmm. They got a totally different cut overseas. To the point where even Terry Gilliam, the writer-director... tried to have his name removed from the American release.
I would like to see both versions. Obviously, the European one first.
No, the one you got to see is the TV version, what's called the Love Conquers All version. Because there was a huge fight with Brazil between Universal and Sid Sheinberg, the head of Universal at the time, and Terry Gilliam. They wanted an upbeat, fun movie, which is, if you've ever seen Brazil, it's not.
No.
Well, they re-edited the movie to the point where the guy gets the girl at the end. They had another director come in and shoot a couple extra scenes to make it a happy ending. They took out almost all the depressing stuff, and that was the version that was sold to, like, you know, UHF stations and that. And it's called the Love Conquers All version.
Wow.
Just to spite Universal, the Criterion DVD includes that version as an extra.
Really?
So you can see just how bad the Love Conquers All version is. So, no. The American cut... it's watchable. Director's cut, brilliant. Love Conquers All version actually probably would be a great Mystery Science Theater because it is so bad.
Speaking of which, I got to give a shout out to the guys at Riff Tracks. I actually supported them, and I got some Riff Tracks for some movies and synced up the audio and video so I didn't have to sit there and wait by the TV even to hit play and all that. I just went ahead and digitized and synced it up. I've been loving the shorts. I've been really enjoying.
I don't know.
I think a bunch of them.
Maybe I'm about to lose my geek cred. I love Mystery Science Theater. Riff Tracks, it's not the same. It doesn't have the same, for lack of a better term, magic that Mystery Science Theater had. Yeah. It's just something seems to be missing.
Okay.
With Riff Tracks, I can't put my finger on it.
I just thought of another movie.
It was the same thing with Cinematic Titanic when they tried that.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, or the film crew. It just doesn't work the same. For some reason, just they don't work the way they're supposed to, the way the MST3Ks did.
I got The Room.
Why?
The Riff Tracks version.
Isn't the theatrical version the Riff Tracks version, basically?
Basically. But it's hilarious. Okay. Real quick,
see,
I have to play this for Dawn.
Well, and see, I'm not going to say I dislike this movie, but I don't understand why this movie is as loved as
this
it is.
One. And
so this is one I'm right in the middle.
Hang on, I'll tell you why this movie is as loved as it is.
David Bowie's
David Bowie's crotch, and women adore this.
You know David Bowie's gay, right?
He's bisexual, actually.
Still.
It's a babe.
Babe
with the power.
What power?
Power of voodoo.
You
do.
They're what?
Remind me, it's the babe.
Quiet!
A goblin babe. Well.
That's all my baby. Crying for the babe.
And I won't subject you to the rest of the song, but I had to get the intro done.
See, I'm a David Bowie fan, and I just...
I'm a big David Bowie fan.
This movie came out when I was 10, and maybe I just was either a little too young or a little too old to have had it.
I think you and I were right in the middle, because Dawn caught it when she was 5 years younger and has loved it. She has worn out 4 DVDs. I don't know how many videotapes of this she wore out. I've had to rebuy the soundtrack multiple times to the point now that I just keep it set aside in a special folder. And when she goes and she goes, my CD won't play in the car anymore, I just burn her another one.
Makes sense.
But yeah, she's a huge Labyrinth fan. Yes? Oh, of course. My brain is not functioning and we have to check. We're halfway through.
Okay. I was pointing at my wrist to try and get him to look at the time to see where, and he's like, what?
I've seen your scar. What are you doing?
I have a big scar down my arm, but I don't know. To me, just Labyrinth just never did it.
Really?
Although I admit I had a monster crush on Jennifer Connelly at the time, which is a little creepy now that I'm in my 30s. But keep in mind, her and I are the same. We're the same age in real life. It's just creepy going back and looking at, she's 15. Is it weird for me to have found her hot, even though I was the same age at that time?
I still masturbate to Jennifer Connelly at 15.
Well,
there, I've just elevated the level of creepy.
You just admitted to pedophilia in a weird way.
Well, there is one thing I have to tell
you. Mental pedophilia.
I don't think there is such a thing, really. But now there is kind of a modern take on cult films.
I disagree. I haven't seen the movie, but from what I have seen of this movie, this is another one that looked like it was trying to become a cult movie when it was made.
No, actually, when it was made, it was okay. It was born out of Jesus Christ Superstar, believe it or not. And the old rock opera movement of the 70s and early 80s.
Quadrophenia and the Wall and
Quadrophenia
that.
And, oh God, that terrible
hair.
Andrew, no, not hair. And the terrible Andrew Lloyd Webber rock, in quotation points, opera with the train. Starlight Express.
Oh, at least do you remember The Wiz? The all-black version of Wizard of Oz?
That was the end of the hey, look, an all-black version of this white movie.
Yeah.
Era.
Yeah, because the movie's pretty fucking bad.
Yeah, it really is.
Michael Jackson as the Scarecrow.
Yeah.
It's
still really bad.
I think Nipsey Russell was one of the main characters. And
we should do an all-white version of The Wiz.
I think they have. It's called Wizard of Oz.
No, we should do because that's Wizard of Oz. That is amazingly white from the ground up. That is one of the whitest movies ever made.
All right, can I be allowed a small side rant?
Sure, go right ahead.
Because you just brought up something.
Yes.
Okay, I'm not a racist.
Yes, you are.
But I am sick and tired of black actors being cast in traditional white roles. They just announced who's playing Perry White, Clark Kent's boss. Always been white. Mm-hmm. In the new Superman movie, Lawrence Fishburne. Why? In the Daredevil movie, Kingpin, white Italian. Let's cast Michael Clark Duncan.
Yeah. I can see why they did
that. There's an all black version of Annie coming starring Will Smith and his children. I'm sorry, that's offensive to me to traditional white characters. I would love to find who owns the rights to Shaft, John Shaft, and buy the rights. And make Jason Statham John Shaft. And I guarantee Al Sharpton and all these people would be out protesting this movie as being racist over taking over a traditional black character and making him white. Okay? White characters should be played by white actors. Black characters should be played by black actors. That's not racism. That is what the characters were.
See, and I mean,
Michael Clark Duncan?
Michael Clark Duncan was the one redeeming thing about Daredevil.
But Kingpin is not black.
I realize
that. He shouldn't
that.
Be black.
But you can kind of see with the modern idea of a gangsta why you would have a very large, very powerful black man in that
role.
So
then explain to me why Lawrence Fishburne is right for the head of the Daily Bugle.
Don't know.
Because I'm sorry, that's totally wrong. You know, that's as bad. Do you know Al Sharpton actually did an All in the Family pilot for the WB in the early 2000s where he played Archie Bunker? I'm sorry, that is offensive to me on multiple levels.
I can understand that.
And yet, if they had done an all-white version of what's happening, Al Sharpton would have been the first one protesting it.
No, I hear you. Also, you know, if anybody ever started doing white entertainment television,
that would be called racism.
Oh yeah, I hear you, but that's a whole other episode.
But you brought that up, and it really bothers me.
Back to this modern, what was supposed to be the modern rebirth of rock opera, and it's not bad. It's not great, and you may have seen that horrible movie from a couple of years ago starring Jude Law, but here's what basically that entire movie ripped off. Oops, did I mute it? I did.
You might want to turn the volume up there.
You know
Bucko.
What? I am a sound engineer. I'm brilliant. I'm sorry.
Idiot.
How old are you?
17.
I had my first surgery when I was 13. Thanks to Z, I couldn't feel or remember a thing. A month later, I was turning tricks.
Drug market, submarket. Sometimes I wonder.
See, to me, Repo the Genetic Opera just is trying too hard to be a cult film. And it, kind of in the same vein as Scott Pilgrim.
But this wasn't. This was.
Sometimes I wonder why.
No, it wasn't. Man.
Citrate comes in a little glass vial.
A little glass vial?
A little glass vial.
And the little glass vial goes into the gun like a battery.
Sorry, I had to get through that part. It really wasn't trying because it wasn't marketed. It wasn't pushed. It just kind of blossomed.
I was going to leave that alone, but if you want to bring it up.
It was a very special episode.
You're a very special in the way that you don't want to be.
It just kind of blossomed into this cult film, and it never really tried. Again, look at Scott Market. Look at the marketing push. Obviously pointed. This one obviously pointed at a very certain audience, our age, by the way, the goth side of our generation. And it, but at the same time, it was never heavily pushed. It was never cross-marketed. It just kind of became and was. And then they remade it into a straight film with Jude Law that was terrible.
Oh, the Repo Men?
Yes.
Well, okay. But you made me think of something else that, because we didn't really prep this because he's been working 13 hours today.
No, so. I apologize. I've been working the past couple of days.
There are other kinds of cult films that, in my opinion, are cult for the wrong reason. Even though a lot of them are good in the sense that I'm going to be bringing up, is that so bad it's good cult film. Like Glitter. Glitter is considered a cult film because it is so god-awful bad.
And I
Battlefield Earth is considered a cult film because it's so bad. Ugh. You know, Plan 9 from Outer Space. That one I'll give you. I'll give you Plan 9. But I think Plan 9 is a misunderstood movie. If does that make any... You know, I'm not trying to...
Plan 9 is just a terrible movie. And I don't get into those. I mean, I realize they're out there, and I understand. And yes, it's entertaining, but at the same time,
but you got to realize, like Brad Jones and I, we love those types of exploitation movies,
oh,
and that
I agree.
That are so terrible that they swing back around to being awesome.
You know, okay, I can see where that is, but I'm for me, they never make that swing around.
Yeah, I know. You're a different type of film viewer than
exactly.
I am, which is why you and I have a lot of conflict over my DVD shelf versus your DVD shelf.
Yep.
There's not a whole lot of crossover between those two things. See, Heather's my problem, Winona Ryder, I can't stand her. I've never been able to stand her, and I really do like Christian Slater a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But why didn't they just go back in time and cast Jack Nicholson when he was 18?
Yeah,
because Christian Slater was channeling young Jack Nicholson.
Oh, yeah.
You want a good Christian Slater cult movie? Gleaming the Cube.
Pump Up the Volume, I think, was better.
It was a better film, but it's not. But that was actually a pretty good mainstream success. Pump Up the Volume made a lot of money.
It's true.
Gleaming the Cube, especially because that was basically a TV movie.
I've seen it.
What's that?
I'm not a fan of it.
Really?
Really.
Well, I was also a skateboarder. You were not a skate punk.
That's
was.
Right.
So to me, it spoke to what I was into at the time that came out. So you have to realize that there's a difference.
And to me, it was a movie made about all the kids that bullied me.
Right. But like I said, I was a skate punk.
I know.
And it's really sad. Sometimes I look at my skateboard just sitting in the garage, and I just kind of go, I'm so fat and uncoordinated, I could not even probably get on that without falling down.
I used to be pretty good.
I used to be pretty good on my board, but I still have my board hanging in the garage, but I'd suck now.
I'd like to see you try. I'm sure you'd do better than I would.
I'm sure it would be a hit on YouTube.
I'm sure you're
watching me break my face.
I'm sure you'd be better than I was, ever was, or would be, or am now. Because I actually attempted to ride a skateboard. No.
You never did?
Not happening.
Okay.
I'd fall off a Segway.
Probably. But, you know, you have those movies that are enjoyed because they're so bad. And I don't disagree with the premise of that. That sometimes they're so bad is why they're so good.
But
I disagree with the movies that people choose, like Battlefield Earth and Ballistic X versus Several and Dungeons and Dragons. And it's like, no, people, these are just bad movies. Not so bad they're good, they're just bad.
Then maybe that's my problem, because all of those that you mentioned are movies that were brought to my attention as, oh my God, this is awful, you have to see this.
You know what's really sad about the difference between us?
What?
I saw all those theatrically.
You also...
I saw all those not knowing that they were going to... I mean, you know, knowing in the back of my head, but not knowing for a fact. I saw all those opening night. And I don't know if that's sad
You working at the theater at the time?
Only for Ballistic X versus Sever.
Okay.
That was the only one. Otherwise, like Dungeons and Dragons, I went to because, you know, we have a topic coming up later on, a show about role-playing games. We're both role-playing geeks. You know, Battlefield Earth I saw because I'd heard, I mean, not reviews, but just all the early buzz was so bad. I went into that looking for redemption. I went into that one going, it can't be that bad.
I've gone into some movies with that kind of, and walked out every time going, okay, yeah, no, that was horrible.
Let's change the topic slightly. You ever walked out of a movie you paid for in the theater? Have you ever just, I can't stand it, I'm done with this movie, I don't care if there's 25 minutes left, I'm leaving?
Yes. And I don't remember which film it was.
I can name one that I did and
Eyes
one that I
shut.
Almost did. See, I didn't see that till cable. I caught Eyes Wide Shut on
Eyes
cable.
Wide Shut. And there were two reasons I walked out of Eyes Wide Shut.
You were falling asleep because the movie's fucking boring?
Yes, I was falling asleep. And the other thing was I took my mom to go see it. Because she
really
was like
a mom film.
She was like, oh, Nicole Kidman, I really enjoy her movies. And oh, Tom Cruise, he's always been good. I remember him from Top Gun. And then...
Then the orgy scene comes.
Then it starts.
And is boring
and I'm
as
just
fuck.
Like, and I'm like, I'm in the theater sitting next to my mom watching Eyes Wide Shut.
See, that's not so bad. My mom took me to see Full Metal Jacket and Platoon and Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Oh, I'll see all the violence in the...
And Blade Runner and Alien and... I know she took me to a couple of sex comedies.
I
admit, it is kind of weird to be sitting there with your mom.
Yeah.
But...
And see, I will go and see all the violent films in the world with my mom. That's not the problem.
It's the sex?
Yeah, it's my mother is so... Look, my mother is so conservative. She gets the willies if I say the word penis.
Ah.
And I mean medical terms. Even if we use medical terms. And you got to remember, my family, full of doctors.
Well, okay, moving back to walking out.
Right.
Almost walked out of one movie.
Okay.
And it was a preview screening to boot, so I didn't even pay for this movie, and I was seeing it the day before it was released countrywide, and that was Godzilla 1998.
That was horrible. Is that the one with Matthew Broderick?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
because some theaters, I think there was like 25 theaters in the country that were given random preview screens. I went to see something else, and they said, we have a secret screening of Godzilla. Would you like to see that? I'm like, shit, yeah? And, you know, I mean, first of all, Sturgeon Bay, fucking Wisconsin is one of the places chosen. Are you serious?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but Godzilla went to school here.
Oh, yeah, he must. Yeah, he did. But so I almost walked out of that. And then this one, anyone who listens to these shows or Radio Drum knows I'm a huge Star Trek fan. When the Enterprise started shooting God with photon torpedoes, I was done. Star Trek V, I just went, no, sorry, this is not Star Trek. This movie hasn't been Star Trek for the last hour and 20 minutes. It is not Star Trek now, and I am fucking leaving.
See, I saw that on video, and I knew going into it that it was going to
be
awful.
I saw it opening night, no reviews. I didn't know it was that fucking stupid.
No, yeah, you did.
Maybe in the back of my head, but
it's
I didn't know
it. It's an odd-numbered Star Trek.
No, fuck you. Brad and I just had a big fucking discussion about that on Radiodrome. I fucking love Star Trek 3. I'm so sick of that goddamn, all the odd numbers one suck. 3 is a far superior film to 4. I like 4, don't get me wrong. But 2 and 3 are beautiful movies back to back. 3, I fucking love that movie. So I'm so sick of this bullshit about, all the odd number movies suck. It's a fucking internet meme and has no backing to it.
Yeah,
and
does.
Yes, my rabid Star Trek fan is coming out.
Yes,
I think you can tell.
It has backing to it, Josh.
No, it doesn't.
Yes,
Star
it
Trek
does.
3 is fucking awesome.
V'ger.
V'ger was in 1.
The Search for Spock.
First real appearance of Klingons in modern makeup, the destruction of the Enterprise, seeing more of the Federation than we ever have before, beautiful fucking performance by Christopher Lloyd and John Larroquette.
Boring.
McCoy gets some of the best lines of dialogue in the entire franchise.
The whole movie is boring and
you're
all
a fucking
talking.
Idiot.
Okay. I mean, 4, yeah, 4 is overrated. Don't get me wrong. I think there's a whole lot
and
of people.
And 4 would have been worse.
I believe it.
With Eddie Murphy.
Yeah. Oh, God, yes.
Because he was originally going to be a fake TV psychic that saw the Bird of Prey cloaking in the park and was running around the whole movie trying to prove that they were either aliens or from the future.
Oh, thank God they didn't do that.
But Eddie Murphy kind of caught his senses and made Beverly Hills Cop 2 instead.
The good man. Good man.
But so that movie could have been worse.
3. All right. You've kind of defended it. I watch the movie and I'm just like, this is fucking ridiculous and boring and all talky, and it's not for me.
I loved it. I
5. We agree on 5.
5 is a fucking piece of shit.
5 is a piece of shit. I'm not a big fan of 6.
See, I like 6. 6 was unofficially called Star Trek 6: The Apology, because it was so much better than 5, and they took it serious again. And when I was on the Projection Booth podcast, we were talking about Captain America, and we segged off into Star Trek. I don't remember how, but we segged off into Star Trek.
Everything we do does.
Yeah, but we segged off into Star Trek, and Mike White put it so perfectly of the reason why he liked 6.
Okay.
You have to remember, when that came out, we'd had about 3 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation at that point, of friendly Klingons.
Yep.
And going back to the badass, paranoid, fucking bastard Klingons was a really nice throwback, giving us one last, man, the Klingons used to be fucking assholes.
Yes.
And he's like, that's kind of why 6 works. It's our last gasp of the good old Klingons before they become kind of pussified in the Next Generation timeline. And you get Worf's uncle defending Kirk and McCoy.
This is true.
Which is pretty awesome. And again, okay, it's pretty clear I like Dr. McCoy. I think he's the best character in the entire Star Trek franchise.
He's my favorite.
He gets all the best lines in all the movies. It's almost like he had something with the writers. McCoy gets, even back into the TV series, you'll notice McCoy got all the best dialogue.
Well, didn't you hear any of the stories about DeForest Kelly?
Yeah, well, he was supposed to be just an awesome person.
Yeah, he was supposed to be one of the, I mean, I wouldn't doubt it if he came and like hung out with the writers for a while and they gave him all the best lines.
But also his character was sort of that curmudgeon American Southerner. His character was sort of the best one to deliver a lot of the smart-ass lines.
My dad's nickname for years has been Bones. And it's not just because he's an orthopedic surgeon. Because
he's Dr. McCoy. He's a real-life Dr. McCoy.
He is a real-life Dr. McCoy. He works at a VA hospital now, so he doesn't get to work with young ones too often. But for lower-income families, he'll go out and do basic medical stuff for lower-income families. He takes joy in giving kids immunizations.
Yeah, you've mentioned that before.
He has absolute joy in looking at a small child and going, this is going to hurt you a lot more than it hurts me.
Well, I was talking to a friend of ours, Mike Fisher, okay? He's older than us by about 15 years, and he's black. And we were talking...
That's racist.
No, because that's germane to what I'm about to say.
Okay, go on.
And we were talking about like the TV he watched growing up versus the TV I watched growing up with that 15-year age difference.
Totally different.
And he said, you know, obviously they watched What's Happening and whatnot, but he said there were two TV shows that both white people and black people loved at the same time. Star Trek and Kung Fu were the two shows that he said the brothers and the crackers liked simultaneously.
I believe it.
Star Trek is one of those, it's really a cross-racial thing as well as a cross-sex thing. It's just as many female Star Trek fans as there are male.
You know, come to think of it.
It's a cross-economic thing. Rich people, I mean, it's one of those, I don't know how we got from cult movies to Star Trek, but fuck it, we're here, so we're talking about it.
Well, we only got 10 minutes, and we kind of finished, and we kind of finished with the cult movies.
That's fine, but I just find it funny that Star Trek is one of those shows that everybody liked. Everybody watched Star Trek. I just find that kind of ironic, and we're talking classic Trek at that point before they became all pussified. I mean, okay, I liked Next Generation, but it was kind of a pussy show when
it really
compared
was
to classic Trek and the movies. It was definitely the Reagan era, you know, just coming off of the Reagan era.
Oh yeah.
Type, you know, Kirk, shoot first, ask questions later. Picard, we need to negotiate. Yes. Negotiate some more. Don't fire.
But and I'll give you Uhura and
Sulu.
Crewman. I was gonna say crewman random skirt. I will give you those. But there were two things that the Next Generation had going for it that were just incredible.
Which were?
Gates McFadden and Marina Sirtis.
I disagree with you on Marina. I've never found her attractive, but Gates McFadden is a total MILF. I like Gates McFadden a lot.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
But I've never had a thing. Marina Sirtis never did anything for me, especially with that giant poof hair she had in the first season.
Yeah, but you got to admit, as they went on, she got better.
Eh.
See, I think she just kept getting better. And then they started shooting for it with Seven of Nine in Voyager. That everybody was going gaga over her. Never, I don't understand what it was.
Well, I like the way Deep Space Nine played with that with Dax. That she was basically a 400-year-old man in a hot 20-something-year-woman's body. And she acted like the old man. I thought that was a nice way to fuck with the audience. That, yeah, she looks really great in her uniform, but her character is a 400-year-old man.
Oh, yeah.
But, see, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I think Next Generation's best season was its first, the most hated season.
Okay, what makes you say that?
It's the only season that totally felt like classic Star Trek with all new characters. The other seasons didn't. When they kind of broke off and did their own thing, and, you know, I applaud them for doing so, but that first season really, especially if you watch those in 87, 88 when they were new, it really felt like just a new version of Star Trek. And I think that just has a certain tone and feel to it that the later seasons didn't. And Deep Space Nine is my all-time favorite. I love classic. I got to go Deep Space Nine is a far better series. I know you're on the fence about that, but
I'm on the fence. I really am. I Deep Space Nine was the beginning of when Trek went from having a hopeful future to having this kind of dark,
well
scary future.
That's what Deep Space Nine was supposed to be. It was supposed to be the dark, ambiguous gray area that you never saw on Classic or Next Generation. You never saw the backroom deals that were necessary to make an empire like the Federation operate. That's where Deep Space Nine, that's their playground, and I loved that.
See, I can see the appeal of it, and I don't say Deep Space Nine is bad. It's just not my thing. And then Voyager just kind of pisses me off.
Voyager just sucked outright. We're going to have a whole Star Trek show at some point, but yeah. Voyager just fucking pisses me off. It was so bad.
Yeah. It was just,
and it
technology hates you, everything in the world hates you, and you have to be a complete slime ball to live.
No, it could have been great if they had stuck with the whole, we're trapped, we can't replenish our supplies, we have to conserve everything, and we're in hostile territory with no backup. But unfortunately, it just was rehashed Next Generation episodes over and over again.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in our Star Trek episode.
Anyway, thanks for joining us. We're out of time.
1201beyond.blogspot.com. Lost in the static show at gmail.com. And this has been Lost in the Static.
All right. And you put such a nice finish on that, but you were 20 seconds early.
Are you going to fucking pad out the time again? Like,
yes, I am, because we get 55 minutes. I'm giving them 55 minutes. There is absolutely no way I'm going to deny them 55 minutes of quality education, entertainment. This is a great show. I mean,